gentlemen. This is your host, Rick Spezak, news director of Progressive News Network. I hope you're well tonight. We have an interesting show for you. You know, normally we deal strictly with the issues that progressive activists bring us, that they're working on different challenges, they're working on different problems. Today I wanted to have a slightly different focus. You know, we know that there are good people working on whether it be environmental issues or social justice issues, but we may not always be aware of the pushback, of the framing that's done that repurposes our good demonstrations, our protestations, our letters, our telegrams, our rallies, and there is quite a bit of pushback. And so we're going to cover some of that tonight. We've got Luis Cuevas from Progressive Push joining us tonight. He'll be my co-host. We've got journalist and blogger Steve Horn, who writes for many different online journals, including Dismog Blog, very involved in environmental issues. And we've got some local activists, Rachel Kajewski, who works with Earth First and several other organizations, has been an activist for many, many years, always on the front lines, always making sure that the truth is heard. And then also Will Bennington, who also brings us an environmental report. And like I said, tonight we're going to be talking about polluters and the pushback against the activist community. So let's start with the news. Generous help. The U.S. has kindly offered to help Japan with the decommissioning of the Fukushima reactors and the problems with the ongoing leakages of radioactive contaminated water. Chief Nuclear Officer Chris Crane and Exelon Generation President John Young welcomed U.S. Senator Barack Obama some time ago. Is the U.S. being a good Samaritan? Well, maybe not. Before the U.S. will provide assistance, Japan has to sign the Convention on Supplementary Compensation for Nuclear Damage. That's the CSC, as known to its friends. This is an international treaty that supposedly provides an international regime on nuclear liability, the who should pay for a nuclear accident issue. The real aim of the CSC, along with other international conventions on nuclear liability, is, I know this will come as a shock, to protect the nuclear industry. It caps the total compensation available after a nuclear accident at a level much lower than the actual costs. The companies that supply nuclear reactors and other materials are exempt. They don't have to pay anything if there's an accident. I guess that works out pretty good for them. The operators of nuclear plants aren't the only ones accountable for paying damages, but the CSC protects them too by not requiring them to have enough money or financial security to, you know, cover the cost of an accident that might go on for, you know, 10,000 years. From the beginning of the use of nuclear power 60 years ago, the nuclear industry has been protected from paying the full costs of its failures. Gee, I wonder if that has any impact on the equation of whether recyclable fuels like solar power and wind power and sea current power are competitive. Maybe if nuclear power had to cover its own costs, the equation might look a little different, huh? Okay. Governments have created a system that protects the profits of companies while those who suffer from nuclear disasters end up paying the fee for themselves. That's right. Here in Florida, we even get to pay for nuclear plants whether they're built or not. How cool is that? Fukushima is a cruel example of this unfair practice. GE designed the Fukushima reactor and built them along with Hitachi and Toshiba. Yet these companies are not being held accountable to cover the cost of the mess that their reactors created. It's the taxpayers who end up bailing out the nuclear industry. Wow, that sounds like a good deal. Even worse, the now nationalized Fukushima reactor, TEPCO, just booked its first profits since the Fukushima disaster, $1.44 billion. In the same time, TEPCO said it won't pay the cost for decontamination of the work area around the Fukushima plant that might exceed, $300 billion or more. And now on another front, Texas frackers sue the victims of their water pollution for $3 million for daring to expose them. The fracking outfit, Range Resources, slapped Texas homeowner Steve Lipsky with a $3 million defamation suit to bully him into silence about his polluted water. But Lipsky's fighting back. Lipsky's a wealthy man, not used to being bullied, but the frackers think they can use control of the state of Texas to bulldoze him. They have bought off the Texas Railroad Commission that supposedly regulates fracking in Texas, intimidated the US EPA into inaction so they don't intend to let minor matters like safe drinking water or private property rights and, you know, that pesky old First Amendment get in the way of their pursuit of profits because, of course, corporations are people too, chum. On October 10, 2013, Fort Worth Court of Appeals ruled that Range Resources could move forward with their defamation suit against Lipsky, based in part on accusations that Lipsky is misleading the public about being able to set his water on fire. In 2010, the EPA issued an emergency order over Lipsky's contaminated water, but then retracted the order a little over a year later with no justification, you know, no data. An AP investigation discovered that Range had successfully pressured the EPA into submission. And although the EPA had water chemistry measurements that showed Lipsky's water was dangerously polluted, the EPA withheld that information, withheld the evidence, vacated the emergency order, and apparently, for political reasons, sat down and shut up. The EPA's actions left Lipsky vulnerable to Range's slap suit. At first, the Environmental Protection Agency believed the situation was so serious that it issued a rare emergency order. You can imagine what it must take to get the EPA to issue an emergency order in late 2010 that said at least two homeowners were in immediate danger from wells saturated with flammable methane. Although more than a year later, the agency rescinded its mandate and refused to explain why. Aha! How cool! Now, a confidential report obtained by the Associated Press and interviews with company executives show that the EPA had scientific evidence against the driller Range Resources, but changed course after the company threatened to not to cooperate with a national study into a common form of drilling called hydraulic fracturing. Regulators set aside an analysis that concluded that drilling could have been to blame for the contamination. As far as Steve Lipsky goes, the EPA decision seems to ignore the dangers in his well, which he says contains so much methane that the gas in water pouring out of a garden hose can be ignited. I just can't believe that an agency that knows the truth about something like this, has evidence like this, wouldn't use it, said Lipsky, who fears he'll have to abandon his dream home in an upscale neighborhood of Weatherford. Because the EPA backed off the case, the Texas Railroad Commission, a regulator completely captured by the oil and gas industry it allegedly is supposed to regulate, was able to hold a kangaroo court proceeding to show that the appearance at Range Resources was the second coming of Snow White minus the seven dwarfs. Range was then in a position to try to silence its critics with the help of a Rush Limbaugh-loving judge. Well, this didn't stop the Railroad Commission, a regulatory agency that governs all things oil and gas in Texas, from holding their own hearings that cleared Range Resources based on evidence provided by Range Resources. The EPA chose not to participate, nor did the Lipsky, since both were only given 10 days to prepare, making a fair hearing impossible. Range Resources spent millions of dollars putting on a one-sided case for the Railroad Commission, attacking all of the EPA's findings. Dr. Jeffrey Thine, who conducted the testing for the EPA, reviewed the Railroad Commission's findings that cleared Range Resources. He wrote, "My conclusion that the gas well could be the source of methane in the Lipsky well water was based on the chemical and isotopic data. After reviewing the Range presentation to the Texas RRC, my opinion is unchanged." Lipsky sued Ranger Resources after the EPA named the company the party responsible for contaminating the well. The family was promptly countersued by Range Resources for defamation. The presiding judge, Trey Lofton, dismissed Lipsky's claims, citing a lack of jurisdiction, but allowed Range's defamation suit to proceed. However, Bloomberg News uncovered a campaign flyer that showed that Judge Loftin had an ethics problem in the case. With aspects of the case still pending in his courtroom, Judge Trey Loftin sent flyers to voters saying that he forced the EPA to back down. Loftin, who's campaigned to keep his state judgeship in a county west of Dallas, also sent materials with the image of a talk show host, Rush Limbaugh, who credited the judge ruling in favor of Driller Range Resources, based in Fort Worth, for getting the EPA to reverse its course. According to COSAC, Texas Sharon, who's obtained a report from a firewalled investigation, Range Resources has been submitting bogus results to the EPA to cover up large-scale water contamination in Lipsky's development. Bruce Payne, a soil scientist hired by Purdue's neighbors as part of the area's long-running water contamination case, said the contamination in the area is much bigger than Purdue's one high reading. He said the EPA has accepted bogus test results from Range and its contractors for Purdue's water well, and 17 more belong to our neighbors. The results submitted to the EPA by Range, he said, include contradictory data. One set shows acceptably low levels of methane in most well water, while the other shows those low levels can't be correct. Independent, unbiased water studies by Duke University scientists have found severe contamination of Webski's water. September 10, 2013, tests show that gas coming out of Lipsky's water well measured 162,000 parts per million, ppm. 50,000 parts per million is considered a level for potential explosion. So, three times the level for potential explosion. Hey, sounds fine to me. Air samples taken directly from the water well headspace showed levels exceeding 900 parts per million. Several residents alerted the Railroad Commission to a new high-level test, prompting the agency to reopen its investigation. Apparently, Range's owners think they can get away with all this because they own the state of Texas and have been intimidated the EPA into silence. Clearly, they've captured the Texas Railroad Commission and the state of Texas. Television reporters have found communications that show Range Resources failed to cement a well to prevent contamination from a gas-bearing layer below from flowing up to the domestic water supplies that Lipsky and his neighbors used. Remember, the whole premise of this is, oh, it's safe because they dig down so very deep, and there's no way that that stuff from way down deep can come up and contaminate the very shallow water resources. Well, evidently, they're just not sealing it off. So, hey, who cares, right? So a review of the Railroad Commission records, News 8 discovered that correspondence between Range Resources and the state regulators, in which the driller agreed it had a problem. In response to the 2010 violation, Range proposed to fix its wellhead pressure by circulating the cement to the surface. Range added, this work is to eliminate any chance the gas could be migrating from any zone down below. It tells me they waited over a year to actually realize they should have cemented to the surface and realized apparently they knew they had a problem. But Range Resources never did bother adding the cement down well. No repairs were ever made. The violation for gas pressure on the wellhead later were dropped by the Railroad Commission, which then went on to rule that Range was not responsible for the flames coming out of Lipsky's water well. The state also said the well is in full compliance with the law. So, hey, how about Texas, huh? Despite the evidence that the fix is in, Lipsky isn't giving up. Perhaps it's because he's a wealthy conservative who still believes the system works for people. Perhaps it's because he still believes the government will protect private property rights against the pillaging by large corrupt corporations. Perhaps it's because he's invested millions into his luxurious property. However, there's a chance that Lipsky is learning that his millions are small change to the oil and gas industry, and they intend to destroy him and anyone who has the courage to try to stop their depredations. Lipsky is now working with attorney Brent Rosenthal, who's preparing to petition for a writ of mandamus in the Texas Supreme Court asking to dismiss Range's remaining claims for defamation and business disparagement against Stephen Lipsky. I will assert, Rosenthal said, as I have before the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, that Range's claims are meritless and threaten the exercise of First Amendment rights by Mr. Lipsky and anyone who speaks out on issues of public concern. I hope that the organization is fighting for its First Amendment rights and social justice, as well as those involved in the environmental movement, will be concerned about the case and will work to persuade the court to reject the claims like Range's against the Lipskys. How about that, friends? Okay, another issue. You'll be happy to hear that all that BP gusher results, all that Corexit and all that oil that, you know, the stuff that magically disappeared. Well, it seems that scientists have saying that maybe that's not quite the case. BP gusher increases flesh-eating bacteria. Alabama Gulf Coast attracts hundreds of thousands of visitors every year. And since 2010, BP oil gusher, tens of thousands of tarballs have been appearing on the beach. A couple hundred miles away at Auburn University, Dr. Kova Arias, professor of aquatic microbiology, conducts research on the often deadly and sometimes flesh-eating bacteria Vibrio vulnificus. Arias' research at Auburn and through the school's lab at Dauphin Island have focused on Vibrio's impact on the oyster industry, which is brought to a standstill 3 years ago by the BP oil gusher. In 2010, out of curiosity, Arias set to discover if Vibrio was present in the post-spill tarballs washing up in Alabama and Mississippi. She was highly surprised by what she found. What was clear to us is that the tarballs contain an awful lot of Vibrio vulnificus, said Arias. Arias can show an observer Vibrio in the lab as it appears as a ring on the top of the solution in a test tube. Vibrio is not something, though, that a person can see in the water, sand, or tarballs. But Arias' research shows it's there, especially in the tarballs and in big numbers. According to Dr. Arias' study, there were 10 times more Vibrio vulnificus bacteria in tarballs than in the surrounding sand, 100 times more than in the surrounding water. In general, the tarballs are like a magnet for bacteria. Arias' theory is that Vibrio feeds on the microbes that are breaking down the tar. She and researchers looked at tarballs that washed up in the same area they had previously studied, so they could therefore make a valid comparison to before the oil spill. And what we found was, in the water, the numbers were about 10 times higher than the numbers we reported before. So the water alone had 10 times as many Vibrio as before the spill, and the tarballs themselves had 100 times more Vibrio than the water. Dr. John Van Wah, an infectious disease specialist at the University of South Alabama's Medical Center in Mobile, said a person can get Vibrio two ways, by eating infected seafood, usually raw oysters, or by being in infected waters, either salt or brackish. In this form, Vibrio is a fact-acting, flesh-eating bacteria. The destruction in arms and legs, the flesh-eating component, is two parts, said Van Wah. One is the organ itself can destroy the tissues. The other is sepsis. Bacteria is in their bloodstream. It affects all the organs. And with my own experience, the mortality has been approaching 40 to 50%. When entering through the skin, Vibrio is contracted through some sort of cut or abrasion. Young or old, someone with a compromised immune system is more likely to get Vibrio. Dr. Van Wah said exposure to Vibrio should be taken seriously by everyone in the marine environment due to the random but deadly nature of the bacteria. It can be very little exposure, just the wrong place, the wrong time. It's not the way anyone would want to die. I hope and pray, he said, that I never have to see anything like that again in my life, said David Cox. His stepfather, Wayne Anderson of Irvington, was killed by Vibrio in September. Anderson was a lifelong fisherman. There was something in the water when he spent his life that it took his life. The Cox said it started as a small bump on his leg. It spread very quickly. The pain was unbearable. You could just see the redness getting darker, the blisters getting deeper. Bigger. Anderson was dead in less than 48 hours. He wasn't one to complain about the pain, and it was helpless to see him begging for someone to do something. It was helpless. Honestly, it was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. There have been almost two cases of Vibrio in Alabama over the last 5 years, according to the Alabama Department of Public Health. Florida recorded 160 cases of Vibrio from 2007 to 2012, with 54 of them being fatal. There have been more than 30 cases in Florida alone this year. In Escambia County, a man died in October. 43-year-old Milton woman, Tracy Lynn Ray, died on November 1st. Relatives tell 5 News she was a frequent beach goer. Arias recommends that people at the beach not touch tarballs with their bare skin. You may have microabrasions, you don't even know you have a cut, so I would stay away from tarballs. Results of Arias' research have not been widely reported. A tropical storm Karen last month washed in a new batch of tarballs at Orange Beach. Sunbathers and beach walkers were oblivious to the danger. No, not really. It doesn't seem to be a concern, said Mike Handley of St. Louis, Missouri. I don't think a tarball that has sand and shells on it is going to impact my health or anyone enjoying the beach at all, said another beachgoer. The bacteria-filled tarballs are an object of beachgoer curiosity. I was just looking for shells in the sand and came across it, said Tara Hadley of St. Louis. Just looking, I picked it up and thinking it was a shell. Walking the beach with her teenage daughter admits to handling the tarballs on a routine basis. Yeah, I've gotten them over our fingers, stepped on them, gotten on our feet. So far, there's no documented cases of someone getting flesh-eating disease from tarballs. Still, Arias urges caution. We don't know if you can get infected with Vibrio vulnificus by touching a tarball, but the possibility is there, she said. BP stresses there is no human case of Vibrio attributed to the contact with tar balls. A BP statement sent to 5 News said, the area study does not support a conclusion that the tar balls may represent a new or important route of human exposure for Vibrio, and the detection of Vibrio in tar balls would impact the overall public health, since there are far more common sources of Vibrio, such as seawater and oysters. BP said it asked the Alabama Department of Public Health in 2012 if its beach cleanup workers were at risk. Dr. Thomas Miller, ADPH Deputy Director for Medical Affairs, replied in a letter there was no evidence of increased cases of Vibrio since the oil spill. Miller indicated, however, there could have been a result of fewer tourists being at the beach. Arias said the only other significant study of Vibrio in tar balls was conducted following the spill off the coast of Nigeria, and it did show similar results. Arias has not done any follow-up work since 2010, citing a lack of funds, but said she would like to do further research. This important story from Scientific American. In Pennsylvania, the closer you live to a well used to hydraulically fracture underground shale for natural gas, the more likely it is that your drinking water is contaminated with methane. This conclusion in a study published by the Proceedings for National Academy of Science in July is a first step in determining whether fracking in the Marcellus Shale underlying much of Pennsylvania is responsible for tainted drinking water in that region. Robert Jackson, a chemical engineer based at Duke University, found methane in 115 of 141 shallow residential drinking water wells. The methane concentration in homes was less than 1 mile from a fracking well, was six times higher than the concentration in homes farther away. Isotopes and traces of ethane in the methane indicated the gas was not created by microorganisms living in groundwater, but by the heat and pressure of thousands of feet down in the Marcellus Shale, which is where companies fracture rock to release the gas that rises up in a well shaft. Most groundwater supplies are only 100 feet deep, but if the protective metal casing and the concrete surrounding the fracking well are leaky, methane can escape into them. The study does not prove that fracking has contaminated specific drinking water wells. However, I have no agenda to stop fracking, Jackson says. He notes the drilling companies often construct wells properly. They do that often. But by denying even the possibility that some wells may leak, the drilling companies have undermined their own credibility. The next step in proving whether or not fracking has contaminated specific drinking water wells would be to figure out whether methane in those wells came from the Marcellus Shale or from other deposits. Energy companies claim that the gas can rise naturally from deep formations through rock fissures, and determining a source is therefore problematic. Yet some scientists maintain that chemical analysis of the gas can reveal whether it's slowly bubbled up through thousands of feet of rock or zipped up a leaky well. Jackson is now analyzing methane samples in that way. Another way to find a leaky fracking well to a contained water well is to show that the earth between them provides a pathway for the gas to flow. Leaky wells have to be identified first, however, and Anthony Ingrafia, a fracking expert at Cornell University, is combing through inspection reports for most of the 41,000 gas wells drilled in Pennsylvania since January of 2000. Thus far, he says, it appears that a higher percentage of Marcellus Shale fracking wells are leaking than conventional oil and gas wells drilled into other formations. Stay tuned for more information there. And now, some Fukushima news. From Dr. Helen Caldicott, the health survey of children in Fukushima Prefecture found that 40% have thyroid abnormalities, which is normally incredibly rare in pediatric cases. Some of these children are certainly bound to develop cancer of the thyroid, and indeed, one 12-year-old boy has already been diagnosed with it, and a girl aged about 16 has already developed cancer. They're testing her now. It took 5 years for the children around Chernobyl to develop cancer. These children are showing symptoms and signs that may well develop cancer in the future, indicating that they got a really high dose of radiation, higher than at Chernobyl. I predict we'll see an epidemic of leukemia and cancer and congenital malformations in this exposed population over the next 70 years or longer. Experts confirm that there is radioactive water on its way to the West Coast. It'll be arriving in the next few months. And the question is, will anybody be told about it? ABC, Los Angeles, November 7, 2013. Fukushima. In-depth look at the potential fallout. The Fukushima nuclear plant continues to spew radiation. It's 5,300 miles from Los Angeles, but still not far enough. Nuclear energy engineer Dr. Arjun Marjani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, confirmed that ocean currents are carrying radioactive water to the West Coast. There are several hundred tons of radioactive water that are pouring into the ocean at the site every day, said Makinjani said. According to studies published in the journal Deep Sea Research, it will begin arriving this March, but Makinjani said there is no need to panic. The radiation will be diluted and levels found along the West Coast are very low and not considered dangerous so far. But the question is, will we really know? I think we should be doing a better job of monitoring food. I don't think that the EPA and the FDA are doing a good enough job, said Makinjani. Susie Taylor from Ms. Magazine said, I was standing in the middle of the road adjusting my camera in view of the Daiichi reactor number 2 when my friend Sonny delivered the news. International wires were buzzing with talk of Fukushima as the Japanese government revealed knowledge of a disaster far worse than imagined. 300 tons of contaminated water were surging into the Pacific every day since the tsunami broke land more than 2.5 years ago. I replied with a speechless stare and returned to what I was doing. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's administration negligently concealed information concerning the fallout on Fukushima while continuing to endanger millions of lives as strontium-90, cesium-137, radioiodine I-131 wreak havoc in the world's oceans. Standing amidst the Fukushima fallout on that day, I had a visceral sense of trouble at hand. Though assigned to produce a video for Time with my partner, I couldn't focus on work. Tears surfaced as I thought of deserted towns we passed. Then I looked out to sea. Somewhere beneath the shoreline, lethal radioactive water was gushing outward. Fukushima mystery. Japan expert says that radiation levels in the ocean are too high to be explained by groundwater flow alone. Must be coming from other contamination routes entering the Pacific. Will there be a devastating impact to come? Yoshihiro Takiwa, NHK reporter. Professor Joto Kanda argues the government statistics don't add up. He says a daily leakage of 300 tons does not explain the current levels of radiation in the water. Joto Kanda, Tokyo professor, according to my research, there are now 3 gigabecquerels of cesium-137 flowing into the port at Fukushima Daiichi every day. But for the 300 tons of groundwater to contain this much cesium, 1 liter of groundwater has to contain 10,000 becquerels of radioisotope. Kanda's research and monitoring by TEPCO puts the amount of cesium-137 in the groundwater at several hundred becquerels per liter at most. He concludes the radioisotope is finding another way to get into the ocean. He's calling on the government and TEPCO to identify the contamination routes other than groundwater. He said if we focus on groundwater too much without contemplating other cases, the situation won't be resolved. Professor Kanda said the volume of radioactive particles discharged into the ocean is much smaller than the volume released immediately after the accident. But he said there must be other sources of contaminated water stored up inside the plant's infrastructure. He said the water is highly contaminated. If it gets in the ocean, it will have a devastating impact. Well, friends, a little something to chew on. And now let me introduce my first guest, my co-host, the brilliant, the hardworking Luis Cuevas. Luis, welcome.
Hey, how are you, bro?
Very good, sir. Very good. And yourself?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
I had a wonderful trip this week. I went out to Chicago, had a chance to talk to a lot of internet professionals, and despite the 4 days of discussion of internet professionals, the subject of privacy and spying only came up once. People tend to, I think, want to look the other way. But yeah. Enough of that, sir. Tell me, what are some of the things you've been thinking about this week?
It's getting interesting, particularly in our state of Florida, to see the politics, how they're developing after seeing what happened in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Here we have the media saying that Chris Christie had an incredible win, that he just, blasted his opponent. And, sure, you look at the numbers, and then you look at the facts. After that, the electoral, once the election is done, and you say, well, he outspent his opponent, I think it was 10-1, for his re-election, The other one thing is that the Buono was abandoned, completely abandoned by the National Party. And there was barely any, show of support. The Governors Association, Democratic Governors Association, they put millions of dollars into Virginia. And they gave Barbara Buono $5,000. You look at those numbers. Then you look at the fact that so many people were told that this is it, it's over, he's won, it's not worthwhile. And, Buono was abandoned. Now, what I want to look at is the fact that we're seeing a similar problem beginning to take place in Florida. Nan Rich, who has been working her way and hard, out to get the Democratic vote, even though it was expected to come out, but suddenly there is this blast about Charlie Crist running for the governorship of Florida as a Democrat, which he has never been. And he has played just about every, what they call that, the shades of gray within the Republican Party. Now he is coming over. And he's, the National Democratic Party is virtually gaga about him. The media is anointing him, as we know, they always do, about these things. And where are the Democrats in the state of Florida allowed to make a decision? It's like, excuse me, there is no right. And if you look at the bylaws of the Democratic Party in the state of Florida, and you hear all these people coming up and saying, Charlie Crist, yeah, ta-da. And then you say, wait a minute, isn't there to be some neutrality? And then you find out that actually there is none. That if you are in the leadership of the party, and that is by one of the writers of the so-called bylaws, whose name we will not expose tonight, but there's this rule that, the leadership is above it all, and they can actually go ahead and they can endorse. So what you've got is that the Democrats within the state don't have a say, and they're confounded by this whole situation here, is a position that, we need a win no matter what. And it doesn't matter what the Democratic Party voters in the state wish. And, of course, many of them are looking – yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, you're going in some just wonderful directions, and there are a couple of things I want to mention before we go too far afield. Yeah, you mentioned the Charlie Crist unveiling, which surprised no one, and nor did the knee-jerk reaction that, oh, my God, Crist, oh, boy, finally, a real person running. And, it's funny. I saw, even though I was out of town and very, very busy with this computer conference, I saw some of my good progressive colleagues here saying, look, Crist is going to appear on the liberal chat shows on MSNBC. Let's contact them. Let's make sure that Nan appears too. So like a lot of other people, I contacted MSNBC and said, look, you can't do this. You can't ignore Florida's Democratic Party, what's been going on for months and months and months and months, and then suddenly this turncoat announces – for all the wrong reasons, and then suddenly, you're going to anoint him front runner. You can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Nan did get a chance to appear. I put our grassroots effort very much in favor of that. And then another thing is on Talking Points memo, a fairly progressive although more liberal than progressive more and more, an online magazine with fairly liberal politics, first announced in the same phrase where they're announcing, Chris, they say front runner, Chris.
Exactly.
So I wrote a letter back. I took him to task. I said, I can't believe you guys who at the first blush of someone who is a turncoat semi-Republican, you're going to anoint them as the front runner. The guy just announced. How is he automatically the front runner? In what race are you running this guy that you see him the front of? You know, and the publisher actually wrote me back and said, well, it's not that unusual for someone who just starts the race to be declared front runner. And I thought, you know, you can lay any baloney down you want, but you don't start a race three quarters of the way down the road and suddenly be declared front runner. Sorry, that doesn't work.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, if you think in terms of when have the 67 counties made decisions about this whole thing. When have the Democrats in the state been asked? And this is all hoopla about, you know, and it happens at other levels too. But this whole thing is about winning. But what exactly do you win? You know, I mean, I think Ted Kennedy put it clearly out several years ago when he said, we already have a Republican Party. We don't need another one. And what is beginning to happen here is that we are seeing more of the same. And, you know, our organization, Progressive Push, we're fighting to get progressives out there elected. And for the last few years, we've been having this problem that we bring them to the surface, we put them out there, we really want to work with them, we really get them out, and then there is this, you know, this National Democratic Party that says, no, you know, it doesn't work that way. We're looking at who, we have 25 races that we can possibly win. We're not going to focus on the rest of them. We're talking about 435 electable positions. So they're going to focus on 25. And they're going to say, well, you know what? We're going to focus first on who's got the money. And if these guys don't have $100,000 to start with, they're dead on their, you know, that's it. No work. Doesn't go anywhere. So there's one against you if you're a progressive candidate, you know, or a liberal Democrat, whatever you want to call it. But the thing is that you have the odds against you. Then they come up and say, well, let's look at who's next. And here is a, you know, I call them the blue puppy, you know, blue dog puppy. What do you call it? Breeding farm, and they go out and say, "Okay, well, where we can win is in the Republican, you know, in the red states. So let's run a, you know, blue dog, because they have the most chances of winning." And the question then comes up and says, "Well, yeah, but they're going to vote Republican. They're going to vote against women's rights. They're going to vote against choice. They're going to vote against LGBT. They're going to vote against, you know, the civil rights, the voting rights. So what is that all? What is that all for? It's self-defeating. But they seem
Absolutely.
To want to perpetuate this whole thing.
Well, I think what you see is the difference between the grassroots who wants an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And what the party writ large wants is they want a victory to put in their feather.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's all well and good, but it doesn't matter if the agenda is Republican. It doesn't matter that you've got another guy in there, because what we want is an actual fire-breathing Democrat. And now I've seen on the social media, I've seen my progressive friends and colleagues, they're supporting Nan. They're talking about Nan's agenda. They're talking about what Nan's trying to do. They're talking about what Nan has in mind. They're talking about the agenda that Nan brings to the state. And what do you hear about Chris? Well, he's electable. He has money.
Yeah.
Well, excuse
exactly.
me. That's you're not winning anything.
Yeah.
You know, do we have to find like the right millionaire? So without the right millionaire, screw any progressive agenda. Is that really
yeah.
the best the party has in mind for us?
Amazing. Yeah, it's you know, what's the difference between Scott and Crist? Except the way that they have handled themselves through the political system in the Republican Party. You see, and we know that Charlie Crist, he has wormed his way around within the Republican Party for years. He's made quite a bit of enemies in there in that process. So, you know, he turns around and says, which other way can I go, you know, to get myself in the leadership? And on the other hand, you have this man who's, you know, a birther, he's a fraudster. You know, this is a man, you know, when we talk about Rick Scott, an individual who has no qualms about doing whatever he needs to win. And, you know, those are the choices that the, you know, the people of Florida are going to be presented with in the end. And then you say, okay, let's take a look at what is the other party in the state of Florida, because we have the Democrats, we have the Republicans, and then you look at the NPAs, no party affiliation. They are the fastest growing party in the United States and in Florida particularly. I mean, we're going above the 33%, if you think of it. And why is it that, I mean, who are the majority in that group? There's a lot. I think about 51% of studies have shown that are really angry Democrats, or what you call them, recovering Democrats, who left the party, the party abandoned them. And they're out there, and they're looking for a cause, they're looking for a leadership, and they're finding themselves with these problems. And why do we repeat this problem? And I'll tell you what, this is not just Florida, because we work with candidates throughout the whole United States. And this is happening in just about every single state of the union. And the other thing that we are finding, and that we are having a lot of problems, and you know, I wish one day you could get Howie Klein in an interview from the Down with Tyranny and Blue America, because they really are hardcore supporters of, you know, rightful progressives. And you see that there is this situation in which progressives are not wanted. You know, progressives, what we're looking at is, we want your energy. We got great energy. You know, we all know that. Well, we want your energy. We want your money. Now, keep your ideas. You see?
Well, you know, that's another thing that annoys the heck out of me. You know, I'm a progressive. I've been a progressive for a very long time, and I've heard a lot of people talk about, we've got to get more women. You know, we've got to fund these progressives. And, you know, I hear that from some of our progressive organizations and women's organizations that, well, they can't support Nan because she doesn't have enough money. She's not a candidate. Well, excuse me,
yeah.
That sounds like a self-proving principle. We don't give her money. She doesn't have money. Well, isn't that fantastic?
Yeah. Well, let me give you a little secret that also happens in here, and I'm going on a limb here. But I've been there. I've seen the skeletons. I've seen this closet that a lot of organizations are self-serving, that they call themselves progressive, sure, and they do the propaganda, but they do their darnest to just get in money, 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 money. And when you look at the FEC files about whom they give money, you will not find it there. They are not funding candidates. If they say progressive candidates, where are they? Where's the money? You know, because I've seen it. And you just need to go to the FEC files and find that out. It's very clear. And it's a problem. It's a serious problem. And that's where, you know, some people got ticked off a long time ago when there was this phrase used as the professional left. But, you know, there is actually, a system out there, and they go out, unlike most of us, they get invited to the White House, and they get to never talk to the president, but they have somebody come down to them, and they orchestrate, and they talk about what the strategies are going to be, you see. But that doesn't get to our candidates. And here's a fight that we need to make. And, it's vote local. Tell our progressives in every state, in every county, in every city, in every election, vote local. Act local. You see, coordinate. And, elect progressives. It will take time. But, you see, that's what the Republicans did 20 years ago. See, and that's how they began to work their way up and win throughout the states. And because Democrats have more voters. But what's the problem? The problem is that the leadership fails to come out and engage the followers and offer candidates that they were willing to support. And that is not, that is why they are losing. And that's where the good fight is. And that's where we are at right now.
I decided many years ago that I was going to try to get involved at the state level just to see what's going on. And the more I saw, the less I liked. And I've been more aligned with the progressive movement in Florida. And the progressive movement joined up with the party, hopefully to bring them around to the progressive side of things. But I'll tell you what, the state party, I'm impressed, and not in a good way. So I'd sure like to see them support someone who is progressive. And
right.
What the only justification I hear about Crist is that, well, he's got money, and the big Democrats, Obama's going to come out and support him. Well, I think that's marvelous. But I just want to know where the hell was the support for the Democrat who's been running for months and months and months out there talking to the ground troops, out there in the grassroots. Don't tell me you're a grassroots party if you ignore the party, the people that come up from the grassroots.
Exactly.
Listen, I've got my next guest on, Luis, so
excellent.
Hang in there. I've got Steve Horn in there. Steve, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Steve, you've been following these environmental stories very closely. And today we're expanding the environmental story to the point where we're looking at some of the pushback. So why don't you tell us about some of the stories you're tracking and some of the pushback issues that you've seen arise.
Yeah, so...
Steve, I've got my colleague Luis Cuevas with me from Progressive Push, a wonderful progressive leader.
How you doing?
Good, good to be here with you. Yeah, so the story I've been working on, or was working on, it's ongoing because the court case, is this issue around a equivalent of a SLAP lawsuit, which is a strategic lawsuit against public participation that's usually applied by corporations to get activists to stop doing what they're doing immediately, or they may face even more serious charges. So and in this case, it was applied to a blogger who writes a lot about the coal industry, and he wrote an article about this guy by the name of Robert Murray, who's the owner of Murray Energy. He called the owner of Murray, he called Robert Murray an extremist in the article and pointed to all kinds of reasons why he thought he was an extremist. About 3 days after that article came out in the Huffington Post, Robert Murray and his attorneys brought a lawsuit against Mike Stark, the well-known author of the blog Fossil Agenda. He used to have a blog called Stark Reports. And so, you know, the two charges are brought against him, defamation, charge one. Charge two was false light invasion of privacy. They're actually two completely contradictory charges. Defamation assumes someone's pretty famous, well-known, and their fame and their reputation was damaged. The invasion of privacy charges, if you read the legal filing, the attorneys do say that this guy was not famous at all. He didn't deserve any of the public scrutiny, so his privacy was invaded. So literally contradictory charges. The reason why the lawsuit was brought, of course, is to basically usher in a chilling effect for other people who want to write articles about powerful people, in this case a very powerful owner of a coal company that gives a lot of money to the Republican Party. He gave a lot of money to Mitt Romney. He gave a lot of money to Ken Cuccinelli in his run for governor in Virginia, which is why that article was written. It was as applied to the Cuccinelli versus Terry McAuliffe race. So the case is ongoing. Mike Stark's attorneys are the ACLU of Ohio and the former senior vice president of the Center for American Progress, David Halperin. So it's an interesting case, and this is a trend on the part of Murray. He's done this to many journalists. Another a big-name journalist he did it to was Ken Ward, Jr. of the Charleston Gazette, who's a major his major beat is the coal industry, so someone like Robert Murray hates him because he actually does journalism that is critical of the industry. So it's a, you know, it's something that Murray's been doing quite often, and it's hopefully something that a lot of other corporate CEOs don't start doing. As of now, it's more of a trend of Murray being an extremist in this sphere, but we'll see if it becomes a trend for the rest of corporations in extractive industries or elsewhere.
And you also were looking into some of the spills was up in Montana, right?
In North Dakota, yeah. So that, Dakota. I'm still covering that. Yeah, I done many Freedom of Information Act requests around it. And who would have thunk it? Well, I thought this North Dakota spill was a huge deal. Just yesterday in Alabama, or maybe 2 days ago, there was a major train crash where 2.7 million gallons of oil spilled. So I thought mine was big. It was just under a million. But I guess even the one I was covering was just trumped by times three. So I don't even know if mine's even a big story anymore. But, yeah, I'm still covering the North Dakota spill of about a million gallons of oil that happened at the end of September during the government shutdown. There's still ongoing repercussions from it.
Also, the First Nations people up in Canada have been getting some pretty hot, what's a good way of putting it, been getting into a lot of trouble with the Canadian authorities as well when they're trying to stop some of these pipelines and some of this abuse.
Correct, yeah. In the, I think, Saskatchewan province on the east coast of Canada, yeah, there's some serious police repression of that activism. Interestingly, there's just a big moratorium that passed in that province for fracking. So it seems like even though there was the repression, the activism paid off.
How's your crystal ball tonight, Steve?
Could be better, but
well, let me ask you this. Confident. If you were to guess whether the president will approve the pipeline the rest of the way or not, what's your guess?
Yeah, I'm leaning towards that he will, but it will be part of a package, and I think it will be, unfortunately, kind of a deceptive package, where my guess would be that it will be combined with some sort of green offsets initiative or some carbon offsets initiative that Alberta as a province will do something more green, or Canada as a country will do something more green to, quote, offset the carbon emissions of the tar sands. That would be my guess, because the topic has been broached in some business media. It's either going to be that or he'll cancel it. So it kind of depends on if that happens. I don't think that it will happen without it being coupled with some sort of, quote, green initiative by Alberta that will, quote, offset the tar sands the reason why I keep putting the offsets in quotes is because that's a scheme that's been proven false. It doesn't actually work. You can't actually offset this carbon once it's in the atmosphere. You just can't put it in the atmosphere to begin with. And it's been a, I mean, that was kind of the basis of the big climate bill in 2009. A lot of the environmental movement was against that bill, the cap and trade bill, because they didn't believe that you can trade away and offset your carbon once it's in the atmosphere. It's the perspective that I agree with. So I would say that if it's going to be approved, that will be something that will be also inserted into the approval, something that Canada has to do. If Canada doesn't do it, then I don't think the pipeline will be approved. So best case scenario, the pipeline's not approved and that offsets thing doesn't happen, because that could be ugly for other reasons.
Sure. Have you heard any more about that that big spill in Arkansas?
Yeah, the Mayflower spill. There's a the latest, there's an ongoing huge court case, class action lawsuit, where Exxon may have to, they're challenging them to pay millions of dollars in reparations for the spill, but the trial won't actually begin, though, until the beginning of 2015. So that's quite a while, given that the spill was, you know, happened in March of 2013, so it'll almost be 2 years later. So that's, other than that, still pretty much a wreck around the area. A lot of people are having a lot more trouble breathing than they had before the spill happened. And but not a lot of media. I mean, the national media kind of went away. I guess it's understandable. It's in Arkansas, but it's unfortunate that after these spills happen, a lot of people leave after the first shock effect, kind of the first shock. Then people come, cover it for about a week, and then they kind of leave, and it's kind of up to the victims to suffer through the rest of the consequences. Hopefully the government will help a little, but in the case of ExxonMobil, they have a lot of power, and they're going to do all they can to make sure that the federal government doesn't do too much, the state government of Arkansas doesn't do too much, and still do a little bit, but the damages are huge, and they'll be felt in that community for a long time in Mayflower.
You know, it's amazing to me. One of the first things I heard about the spill was that the FAA bought into the bogus let's cover this up because, my gosh, if there was a fly zone, you know, we just couldn't have the press up there documenting this. You know, I wonder if that's going to be the new modus operandi of these big spills, because, of course, the spills won't be going away. It's just they're going to be making it easy for the press to ignore them.
Yeah, and I was the one who actually broke that story about the FAA and the no-fly zone in Arkansas. I just happened to notice that it was, I guess it wasn't the one to break it, but there was a local media story that buried it kind of at the bottom of the article, and I thought that in of itself that was a huge development. So I did a little bit of research and made that the headline, and the story went, got out there pretty widely. The thing is that, that didn't actually happen in the North Dakota spill. I think it only depends on how powerful the company is. Exxon's really powerful, so that's what they'll do. It shows how much, I guess you can see relatively how much power the corporation has compared to the government in cases like these. Another example is BP had the ability to get the FAA to implement a no-fly zone when they did their big spill in the Gulf. So those are the two big ones. McKay, you know, didn't happen in North Dakota, though. That was a smaller company by the name of Tesoro. So it just all depends on what company it is. But I do want to say one other interesting, while we're on the beat of oil spill cover-ups, the company that Tesoro hired is the same company that Exxon hired in Arkansas after the spill to help them with spill management and cleanup, which is company by the name of Witt O'Brien's, which used to actually funnily be called OOPS Inc. as an acronym, OOPS Inc. They forgot exactly what that stood for, but I wrote an article about it after Arkansas. Basically, they come in and help with all these communications efforts and public relations efforts, and really focus a lot on how can we best help you as a company deal with, you know, the aftermath of you guys just did a lot of damage in these communities. How can we help your public reputation? So they're back on the scenes in North Dakota right now, which is what I learned that from doing my Freedom of Information Act request. And it's just interesting. There's a whole industry, a big company by the name of Widow Brian's that literally just exists, or one of their main purposes for existence is to be there to help for crisis communications after big spills. And I guess for the next spill, if you just, it's kind of like a playbook. You can kind of expect them to be on the scenes after a big spill happens. They were there for the BP spill. They were there for the first BP spill. Oh, sorry, the first Exxon spill in Valdez, Alaska, in the late 80s. They're there for the Arkansas Exxon spill, and now they're back to the big North Dakota spill. So they're constant presence after oil spills.
If you have a question, Luis, go ahead. Okay, while Luis is thinking of one, Steve, let me ask you another question. Go ahead, Luis. Okay. Steve, while we got you on the phone, in addition to the environmental beat, what other stories are you working on right now?
Oh, what other stories I'm working on? Well, I've been long fascinated with this firm by the name of Stratfor, which is short form for Strategic Forecasting Inc., and this firm was the one that WikiLeaks put tons, I think hundreds of thousands of emails that they got from a hack from Anonymous. And the emails are interesting in themselves. I'm actually, although the content of those are interesting, I'm really interested in the history of that firm. I recently got confirmation that Louisiana State University's archives, their historical archives, has a lot of stuff, a lot of documents on Strategic Forecasting Inc.'s precursor, which is the Center for Geopolitical Studies at LSU, and doesn't exist anymore. It exists from 1994 to 1996. So I think soon I'll have a lot of very interesting documents on sort of Stratfor's rise to power, which most people don't really pay much attention to. It's been much more interest in the immediate court cases around Anonymous as an hacktivist entity, a lot about WikiLeaks and all the controversies around WikiLeaks. But I'm really interested in the actual firm itself, Stratfor, and kind of just sticking to the immediate reason for why WikiLeaks and Anonymous did that hack, and that's the firm itself. And how it's very, very interesting firm. Basically, their claim to fame, they gather a lot of intelligence on activists, and also came up with a formula to conquer and divide activist movements to ensure that, they ensure to their clients, or so they say, that they can guarantee that activists will never win. Which, I mean, they're very sophisticated, and I think a lot of times they've been successful over history. They've existed since the 80s in different names, and I'm just excited that I'll soon have those documents from that historical archives at Louisiana State University.
Yeah, there was a story I saw over the weekend about the mother of...
Barrett Brown, right?
Yeah, Barrett Brown, yeah, thanks. She's only going to be under probation for misremembering where her son's laptops might be.
So that's another interesting tie, because Barrett Brown was a spokesman kind of for Anonymous, and Barrett Brown helped with that Project PM, which I think did the important part, which was, well, these documents are public now. I mean, they were hacked, and they were put into a public database in WikiLeaks, so it's responsible for any journalist who thinks that it's important material to work with these documents to see what kind of stories there are. So he helped facilitate that with his Project PM, but he wasn't just him, it was him and many others. And so now, because he was participating in Project PM and apparently shared some of the documents on stuff that hadn't been made public yet and shared a link, he's now being prosecuted by federal courts and could face 105 years in jail, which is really scary, because Barrett Brown was, besides just being the spokesman for Anonymous, he did actually write articles for news websites, including Vanity Fair, The Guardian, et cetera. So it's a very scary precedent. And what I'm writing about is the history of one of the firms that he was doing research on. I think sometimes the press mischaracterizes it. He's not being prosecuted because of sharing the stuff on Stratfor. I think he's being prosecuted for some of the stuff he shared on another firm by the name of H.B. Gary, which does similar work to Stratfor. And he was doing work on all of these firms. He's really interested in the kind of the corporate intelligence industry complex. But in his prosecution was because of H.B. Gary and some offshoot stuff that's happening to his mom. And that's a tragic situation.
It certainly is. And, you know, the more they can criminalize political reporting, the less we're going to know. In this overall security state that we find ourselves in, you know, it's a shame that all this let's look forward, not backward, only works for people seated in high civil service jobs. It doesn't work so well for journalists and bloggers who are trying to spread information.
Right.
If you were to,
go ahead. I was just saying that there's an interesting common thread between even the smaller, more micro case of Mike Stark and the big case of Barrett Brown. That's the common theme is that it is intimidation and prosecution of work that journalists are doing from various perspectives. Much more minor Stark's case compared to the case of Barrett Brown, obviously, but nonetheless, it still has a chilling effect on journalists. In both spheres.
Yeah, it could be worse. We could be reporting on General Petraeus, huh?
Yeah, which is something else I've been doing. You know, so who knows? It's just can't be scared, but doesn't mean that it's not scary. I guess that's the best way I can put it. You can't be hip to have no fear, but you should definitely be aware of what's going on.
Well, you know, you look at the political assassinations that we know about, and they're still debating the Kennedy assassination. They're still they don't talk much about the assassination of Dr. King or Bobby, but it's something that those of us who look at politics and look at reportage have to wonder about. You know, these are stories that still there's a big question mark written over. And there are people that know, and then there's the rest of us.
Right.
If you were to say the story that's made the most impact, as we're coming down here to the end of this 2013, whether it be an environmental story or just another political story, what's got your vote for the most significant political story of 2013?
I would say that's a hard one, but I think that I think hands down the stuff with Edward Snowden and the NSA documents is a kind of sounds like an easy way out. But just the actual impact that those stories had, they kept coming. They're still not stopping now, and they've been so powerful that people in power have had to respond to them. And there's calls for reform now by the powerful people in Congress. Al Gore just recently talked about it, former Vice President of the United States of America. So. You're talking about impact reporting plus just the quality
right.
of the reporting. I would say that shows the power of good journalism. So I would say that one, just based on its impact alone, it helps that huge newspapers are writing about them. The mainstream media eventually had to report on it. The New York Times, following the reporting of The Guardian and The Washington Post, Bart Gellman and Guardian, Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras. So, yeah, that's by far, I think that's the story of the year, just by its impact alone. I can't think of anything else that's had that kind of
impact. Let me ask you a related question, then I'm going to let Lewis ask a question if you'd like. My related question is this, Steve. You know, you're a reporter. You're covering a beat that the mainstream media typically ignores. If Nancy Pelosi and people who think like her get her way and they start licensing journalists, would you apply for a license?
Oh, yeah. You're talking about the
legitimate
the
journalists
media.
Versus the rest of us, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I would because I think that would mean a certain kind of that's a scary precedent. But I don't know if I want to be that kind of journalist who would get that license.
There's a reason they call it embedded.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. So really
Luis, do you have a question for Steve, sir?
Well, yes. One of the things that has been bothering me is the fact that not only is the Harper administration in Canada pushing all these things, and of course with we got the Koch brothers in the U.S., but we are also having pressure from so-called liberal Canadians like Justin Trudeau, who has been coming down to the United States and has been talking to people in high places in government and pushing for the Keystone Pipeline. This is all done on behalf of this whole energy, for the United States and all that. And I want you to clarify, if you will, this point that this is not really energy for the United States at all, and that what TransCanada is doing is for TransCanada itself.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question for two reasons. The first one is that, like you said, Trudeau, I think he recently went to the Center for American Progress's 10th anniversary gathering, and a big topic of that gathering was energy and the Keystone XL pipeline and the tar sands. And yeah, he played the role of the contrarian there, where he was really into the tar sands and building that pipeline. And I mean, I think that's the role he's playing. He's definitely doing the bidding of the industry there in Canada, which is the tar sands industry, their biggest industry. And I know I want to add to that that the British Columbia government just signed an agreement with the more conservative Alberta government for pipelines to go westward
right.
to British Columbia, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, I think it really shows that the Canadian government has been captured by the industry. I mean, it's the biggest industry, and it's an international industry, and it's a powerful industry. So governments are largely captured by the same industry. And
yeah.
Talk about the pipeline. Yeah, both the U.S. and the Canadian government. The Canadian government probably even worse because it's their industry. And the United States is just the facilitator of the pipelines for those
right.
sand. So
right.
to get to that question,
right.
yeah. So
this oil is going to China. This is not going to the United, for supply of energy to the United States. This is
yeah.
all going over to China for export. And the other one part is that the southern leg is already been built.
It's already been built. Exactly. Yeah, that's a key point to make that not a lot of environmentalists like to talk about, but it's 95%, basically 100% built at this point, and it's just a matter of time until they start actually pumping the oil through it officially for the markets, for those same markets you just talked about, and it's the export market. And it's not just Asia, it's also Europe, but it's not the United States and
right.
not North America. Yeah, so and some of it is, but a lot of it's not. And so even if a lot of it's not, it's a lot of something that they're not talking about, which is that it's just big energy security issue and this ethical oil issue. But you know, the industry is a global industry. Oil
mm-hmm.
gets exported and imported from other countries. Still a lot of oil is going to come from Saudi Arabia and the Middle East, Central Asia, et cetera. So it's misleading. But not surprising that the industry would
sure.
use self-serving rhetoric to swoon a lot of well-meaning Americans into believing
yeah.
that this is, yeah. So, yeah, that's the situation is that a lot of it is exported. I mean, I'm sure some of it's still refined in the Gulf Coast and used down there, but a huge quantity of it is not. A lot of it's going to be exported.
Right.
Well, gentlemen.
And a lot of, I would say the other thing, the last thing is that British Columbia deal, that one's also an export pipeline to Asian markets, goes to the west coast of Canada. The closest countries to that it would be exported to are the Asian countries.
Well, I need to bring on my next guest, gentlemen. So
right.
thank you, Steve. Thank you so
thank
much
you.
For joining us. And,
yeah, thanks for having me.
Luis, if you can stick around between this one and the next one, we may have a minute or two to
sure
chat.
Thing.
Okay, great. So this is Rachel Kajewski. She's with Earth First, and other environmental groups. She's going to talk about recently a presentation they were doing on GE trees. So here we go. We've all heard of GE food or genetically modified food. This is about genetically modified trees. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome a good friend of mine, an activist, a woman who's been fully committed to making this a better world for many, many years. She's working very much in the environmental movement these days. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Rachel Kieski, and I'm a member of Everglades Earth First.
Rachel, you know, we met many years ago when you took a very bold stand by suggesting that racism might eventually fade away. And, and you did it with some grace and some humor, and I was very, very proud to stand beside you. And it's so nice to see you continue your commitment to make this a better world, and that's why I invited you on. Rachel, you're part of Earth First. They're working to help people understand the issue and the threat of GM trees, genetically modified trees. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, in one aspect, both of us are living in the Southeast right now, and we live in Florida. The U.S. government has a new bioeconomy plan to turn the Southeast into tree plantations to fuel the living carbon future of the U.S. They want to shift from fossil fuel dependency on foreign exports to quote-unquote renewable resources because of the South's biodiversity and ability to sustain genetically engineered trees. Up to 11 billion gallons of living carbon fuel is the projected expectations that the Southeast will be able to reduce for the United States and for abroad.
Wow, I could see how this genetically modified living carbon benefits the chemical industrial industry, the genetically engineered industry. I don't see how it really solves the carbon problem or weans us from that. But I think what the movement to inform people about the GM tree threat, they raise some other issues about monoculture. When they refer to monoculture with trees, what are they saying?
When they're referring to monocultures with trees, trees from the Forest Service are treated as crops. They're treated just like corn, they're treated just like wheat and soy, they're highly pesticide-ridden, herbicide-ridden, they're sterile environments. These genetically engineered trees are engineered to be sterile, even though 5% of them actually won't be sterile, because of the way that
nature
they can't
is.
Full sterility. Yeah. And so the contamination rates of other native trees are high.
One of the other things I noticed was they were talking about the fact that in a real natural forest, because of the normal biodiversity, you have tall plants, short plants, medium-sized plants, you have ground-dwelling plants, you have a diversity of trees, and with that diversity of trees becomes a room for a diversity of life. And as you mentioned, with this sterile environment, with just one type of tree that's being treated like a crop, not in any way at all organic, plus some of these, just like the GM foods, come pre-installed with pesticide right inside them.
Right. Exactly what you said. They're going to be sterile environments. There won't be abilities for biodiversity to exist. Not with trees, not with plants, not with animals, not with the fungus. It won't be an ecosystem at all.
Okay, we've got that problem. And of course, what the average person hears about is the miracle of modern science. The genetically improved crop. What they rarely mention is when they say genetically improved, what they mean is genetically modified to have a greater and greater and greater tolerance for more pesticide. And of course, when you put more pesticide in the environment, you don't have a normal environment anymore.
Absolutely, you don't have a normal environment anymore. Not all of these trees, the trees that we're specifically talking about is genetically engineered eucalyptus. Right now the USDA is considering legalizing them for commercialization for the first time in U.S. history. These eucalyptus trees are going to be modified for their lignins. the lignin amount is going to be adjusted so they can be either pushed through paper mills more easily or converted into pellets for biomass incinerators or turned into biofuel.
One of the other issues that has arisen when scientists working for these genetically modification pharmaceutical or biochemistry companies, one of the other issues that rises is these are not being done always in isolation. And what's happening is, despite the fact that in many cases they are prohibited from putting these into the wild, more and more times we're discovering, like that field of grain up in the Northwest, that they're putting these genetically modified crops out in the world, and they're interacting with the natural world's crops. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. Absolutely. With genetically engineered trees, the test plots that aren't approved already for commercialization are anywhere from a small amount of an acre to a couple acres large. And even if they're bred to be sterile, the tests of how the impacts of pollen will have on not just other trees, but wildlife, animals, and humans is not being considered. The test plot ability to contaminate is not actually being analyzed.
Right. Now, another aspect of this dangerous experimentation is that with these crops being released into the wild, they interact, and there are times when, despite the fact that these genetically engineered trees are bred to officially not have pine cones because they regard that reproductive part of the system as extraneous and not financially viable, we do have the potential for these crops interacting with native plants and creating completely unconstrained changes out in the natural community that get spread. So it's kind of like Frankenstein out of the box.
Absolutely. Unpredictable. And these test plots are only being tested for 3 to 5 years. Humans have only been around we've been only doing agricultural work for 10,000 years.
Yeah.
As a species. To think that we know what the outcomes will be of a 3 to 5 year test is absurd.
Now, that brings us to a whole other issue. Now, there are people that would just prefer to bulldoze right through public opinion with their slogans, with their expensive commercials, with their fact-free infomercials wrapped around news programs.
Arthur Daniel Midland.
But there are other people, thoughtful activists, who prefer that the public be informed. So isn't it true that there has been recently a tour of environmental activists who've been trying to take information out to the public, to the universities, for example, and help people understand the issues that really are critical for them to consider? Could you talk about that that information tour?
The Global Justice Ecology Project, a project that's been around for over 10 years fighting tree plantations and genetically engineered trees, they decided to do a tour of the Southeast because, as I mentioned beforehand, the U.S. is trying to make the Southeast a haven for biofuels, a part of their future bioeconomy plan. With that information, the Global Justice Ecology Project went on tour going to cities that are either already directly impacted because they have either ArborGen or a corporation that has intent to create a biomass facility or are already working on GE trees. For example, the University of Florida is doing tests on loblolly pines. And so trying to get information out to the public that is directly affected or will be affected by these tree plantations, because public awareness about it is still low. And that was what the tour was trying to do, is do more public outreach to a audience that doesn't actually have a say in this decision. The decisions that are being made by corporations and universities and the government, not the people.
You know, it seems to me that the worst thing you can say about the activist community, at its less than shining example, is where people yell or scream or blockade to a point of shutting down a conversation. But I think what we had here is completely opposite. what we had here is the activist community reaching out and saying, these are facts that we have. We want you to understand these facts. So they were doing a tour of universities to help people understand the issue, to have the facts that they wouldn't otherwise have. Now, what happened when these activists went to UF?
So we had scheduled October 1st our presentation to occur. And within 4 days of our presentation, they canceled our presentation. And we went on the Saturday, we went to the building that we were supposed to present in to try and discuss the issues of our cancellation. There's been an interesting amount of press regarding this subject. The university police and the university have tried to put us in as worst light as possible. But whenever the subject is brought of whether this was political or not, the university doesn't comment. The way that we were treated, even before we went to the university, was incredibly atypical. They communicated to the student organizer, sorry, we don't. Your event's canceled. We'll happily put a sign on your door, on the door that's saying it's canceled. They made zero effort to relocate us, get us another classroom, anything that a normal presenter would, any normal courtesy a presenter would get in regards to giving a basic presentation in a public information campaign.
Now, this was invited. People were invited to come and do this presentation by students and faculty, correct?
Yes.
Now, did they offer any excuse at all?
Their excuse was that the AV equipment was down.
Certainly a facility like the University of Florida in the city of Gainesville has probably has more than one video projector.
Yes. Upon further investigation, it was brought to light that there were actually 4 rooms available in that building. There were no scheduled events during our time, and they were informed that we didn't have to use their AV equipment to give our presentation. We were, as far as we knew, faculty were coming to our event. We had students of the forestry department that were coming to our event. Announcements were made all over campus regarding this and all over Gainesville.
Now, let's talk turkey, if you will, in today's contemporary mercenary culture. There's an awful lot of funding that comes to the forestry department from these people who want to build GM trees. Is that correct?
Yes.
So it's a big funding base. And it seems that the facts might have gotten in the way of some big funding. Now, as I understand it, the university wasn't happy merely canceling the event. They went a few steps further, didn't they?
Yes, they did. When we went on Saturday to discuss the issues of the room cancellation, we were approached by police officers and given a 3-year ban from the university, giving a trespass warning. Regardless of the mix-ups and miscommunications with the cops, we had a faculty communicate with the police officers within that 2-day period, requesting our presence on the campus to give the presentation as an alternate location, and we were denied that access. The best we could do is we could give a Skype presentation to his class.
Incredible.
But that did not substitute at all for the audience that we were going to get at UF.
And I'm sure that the average, well, no, maybe not the average, but a professor at a university, and I'm sure someone at least took a stand saying, you know, the point of a university is to have a diversity of opinion, to expose people to different kinds of thinking, not just to the commercially viable world, but to other alternative ideas. And in fact, this was not welcome, was it?
No, it was not welcome. UF is getting over a few $1 million in research from ArborGen, the corporation that is producing this genetically engineered eucalyptus.
I found some information online that I wanted to run by you. Information I found online said that in 2011, the University of Florida School of Forest Researches and Conservation, along with the GE tree company ArborGen, won a 3-year, $6.3 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to develop GE, or genetically engineered, loblolly pines for liquid biofuel production. And it also says that the professor, Bron Taylor, who teaches a course on environmental ethics, which I think would be the place to discuss this issue, was very disappointed about the cancellation and said the university is supposed to be a place characterized by free and robust debate. This situation begs the question, why was the presentation canceled and why were these activists banned from campus under a threat of arrest? Now, just to make a personal reference for a second, I was once thrown out of a free school for not being Marxist enough, so I have a little experience with being banned from a school. I thought to be banned from a free school definitely was a plus in my favor, because if you're getting banned from a school, you're probably doing something right. So congratulations on being banned from the school, and a huge black eye for any kind of academic integrity. The fact that you could be banned for wanting to present information, that's unconscionable. That there is no appeals process is literally, I think, a crime against science as well as a crime against the academic community.
Just for clarification, if we wanted to get the bans lifted, we would have to write a letter to the chief of police requesting our ban be lifted.
Well, you know, if it was me, and it's not, if it was me, I would literally set up a table and a screen immediately off, 5 feet off campus, and show the damn film there.
Yeah, the campus takes up half of Gainesville. To be banned from the University of Florida is to be banned from half of Gainesville. But stolen land anyways.
There may be a free speech zone you could appeal to.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Okay, let's move on to another arena. And I really appreciate your time, because unfortunately, most people, when they hear genetically modified or genetically engineered, they think the products or crops are being improved. What they usually don't hear is the real full truth of this, that it's being improved strictly for economics, strictly to make sure that they can use even more pesticide in our environment than they're already using, which is plenty and then some. Now, I want to talk about another issue. There was a part of a rally to discuss what's called Smash HLS, and there was some information that came from that. Now, Smash HLS stands for what, or what is it in opposition to, Rach?
It's South Florida Smash Huntington Life Sciences. It's an animal rights group that does protests and targets corporations that are exploiting animals, either for transport to sell or for animal experimentation or things regarding SeaWorld or any sort of animal exploitation where animals are being used for human profit and not being treated properly.
Okay, so we've got a situation where some activists came together to protest this facility, right? Now, what happened at that protest?
The details of what happened exactly at the protest can't be discussed beyond
what
was...
Oh, I see. That's right. It's a legal matter. Let me sketch things out, and then you can say, am I right or am I not, if that's possible. I found from a resource online, there was a protest, and let's see here. The protesters were surrounded on all sides by unmarked cars and plainclothes police, Florida Department of Law Enforcement, the Department of Homeland Insecurity, and they aimed weapons, and officers were arrested these people with extreme, enthusiasm, because they're so conscientious about subduing peaceful activists. Now, these people who were protesting this abuse of animals were then subjected to huge fines and bail. Isn't that true?
Yes. $31,000 total in bail for 9 people.
Now, had they damaged a building, broken a window, thrown a rock, knocked down a fence, or were these just activists gathered to protest?
They were activists gathered to protest their First Amendment rights, and in regards to what can be said, police have already openly admitted that they antagonized the protesters,
right,
and that it was a setup.
Okay. Now, this is not the first time where we've had activists arrested, intimidated, abused, violently subdued, which they have that lovely phrase for, resisting arrest
without violence. Extraordinary stuff. But so often we find ourselves in situations where activists are being pressured, antagonized, set up to really stifle dissent.
Yes, specifically Smash HLS has been watched by agencies for a few years now because of their effectiveness. They effectively dismantled most of Primate Product, a corporation that sold and transported primates for animal testing and sold the devices to restrain them. And they were able to get airline contracts of transportation canceled. They were able to get people to quit their jobs. They were able to get Primate Products to shut down one of their main facilities. This is a group that's effective, and any way that the state can stop them from being effective, they're going to try, and this is one of the ways that they did it.
Okay, now, they were going to do a presentation at Palm Beach State College at the Environmental Club. This presentation was also blocked when a provost claimed that they'd been contacted by the FBI, who informed her that these were disruptive individuals. They were disruptive because they changed, they were providing information when information really wasn't wanted, were they?
For clarification, it was Global Justice Ecology Project and Everglades Earth First that were giving a presentation, not Smash HLS.
Okay, thank you. That's very good. So Everglades Earth First and, I'm sorry, the other group was what?
Global Justice Ecology Project.
Global Justice Ecology. My God, mm-hmm. Advocating for global justice for ecology. What a genial sounding organization to ask for justice for the ecology so that, you know, we can live on a livable planet. My God, what a radical idea. And so they were discouraged. Was that presentation also prevented?
So that was on a Wednesday, and Monday was supposed to be our presentation at UF. So 2 days after our presentation was supposed to happen, we approached Palm Beach State College and were allowed in to the classroom. But within 5 minutes, the provost came, approached me, asked who, very, very roughly asked who was giving the presentation, and then when they found out who I was, they accusingly said that they knew me and took the main student organizer out. And when the student organizer came back, they communicated to us that the FBI had contacted the provost and informed the provost that we were a disruptive group. And so the provost did allow us to give the presentation with the security guard posted outside the room during the whole of our presentation.
Tell me, was the security guard outside able to prevent any ideas from entering the room?
Luckily, no.
Oh, good. You know, it seems to me that in a world where documenting animal abuse is a crime, where a person like Sinclair Lewis, who exposed the violence and inhumanity and the stockyards in the 1920s, where he would be viewed as a criminal radical, I think this is noble work. In summation, if we were to look at this whole situation, is the information going to continue? Will we be able to hear somehow, somewhere, this story of the damage that this genetically modified trees is bringing to the South? Is the group going to try to continue to get the information out?
Absolutely. The Center for Food Safety, a rather large nonprofit, just put out a 75-page report about genetically engineered trees, and we will be having a strategy meeting. Me as a representative from Everglades Earth First, the Global Justice Ecology Project, the Center for Food Safety, representatives from the Center for Biological Diversity, NGOs from all over the country and from the world are going to be meeting on the 18th of this month to discuss next steps in regards to fighting genetically engineered trees. Public opposition is growing and growing against genetically engineered trees with the understanding about and the connections between genetically modified organisms and their food. When the USDA opened up public comment about legalizing and commercializing genetically engineered eucalyptus, there was 40,000 comments against commercializing GE eucalyptus. There was only 4 comments for. And so if we can continue getting public awareness and public opposition, we can stop this before it gets out of hand, like the GMO food crisis has gotten out of hand.
You know, recently we saw the defeat of the labeling initiative in Washington State because there were just tons and tons and tons of money poured out on the issue, and they were able to obscure it and block it. Clearly, more and more people are becoming aware. But it seems to me that when the simple request to be informed that food is being tampered with, when even that is being blocked, clearly they're setting themselves up for a big fall. And I sure hope that the word that you're working on getting out about the danger to genetically modified food and genetically modified trees, I hope this gets further out. And we certainly support your effort all the way. And if there's anything else we can do, please let us know and keep us informed. Unfortunately, we live in a world where those of us who have humane values, those of us who care about people, who aren't prepared to write off children, the poor, the elderly, the infirm, we're trying to build a better world. And those people who only see dollars, you know, they're creating a disaster for themselves. So I salute you, Rachel, and the work that you're doing. Keep up the good work and keep us informed, please. It's a multi-front battle. If there's one thing you want to leave, maybe how can people get involved to help support the work? Where would you direct them?
There's two things I want to say, Rick. We need to stop genetically engineered trees before they get commercialized. Getting GMOs labeled isn't stopping GMOs. And if we got GE trees labeled, it's not going to stop the dangers of GE trees.
Sure.
So it's really important to act now. How people can get involved is go to look up Global Justice Ecology Project. I believe it's globaljusticeecology.org, but I'm not positive. And they can also read the document from the Center for Food Safety about GE trees, sign the petition to not commercialize genetically engineered trees, and get in contact with organizers in Global Justice Ecology Project so you can organize in your area that's going to be impacted by this.
Thank you so very much, Rachel, and tell your brothers and sisters in arms we're with you.
Thanks, Rick.
Bye-bye.
So, Lewis, how about that? The good students of UF were protected from the dangerous information about genetic modification.
No. I know how the University of Florida works. I'm a graduate. I taught there, retired, and I'll tell you, it's one of the most incredible repression machines that I have seen in the last few years for a university. They're very good at putting pressure on students for activities, to the point that if you were going to get street theater as activism, you not only you have to get special permits, but there are strict regulations regarding what you're going to wear as costumes and all that. And the punishment, yes, and the punishment is incredible. So the students are incredibly repressed. Now, if anybody is wanting to come to the university, to Gainesville, Florida, and put the word out and reach out to the community and to the student community, the best way to do it is through organization called the Civic Media Center in Gainesville. And either them or I can put them in contact. You can connect me with these folks, and we could go ahead and we can, we can have activities in, throughout the area. We know how to get around these things. But essentially, there is a very repressive system there. Remember, this is a place where we had the don't taste me, bro. Remember that?
Yep.
Then, there was later an even a worse situation in which is this gentleman is having seizures, and somebody calls the university police, and they said, we don't want this man to hurt himself. They go in there, and they actually shoot the guy.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It was a scandal. It was a university police. It just goes there. It's like a Gestapo. And it's a horrible situation. And then we got this president, Bernie Manchin, who comes from Utah. He's a dentist. He believes that universities should be handled like a business. And he's done some of the most awful things, here. And he really has done the most to repress student activities on campus. And in spite of that, they try, and they have multiple organizations, like a Student for the Democratic Society, and their whole activities at the very beginning of the year to contrast, for example, the fraternities, sororities,
sure,
events at the very beginning. Well, they have an actual activist, rush. To counter that, when they give students the chance to see that there's other things that they can get involved with in terms of the common good. There's ways around.
I've got one more presenter. My final presenter of the evening is one of the people who was actually there at UF. Luis, I want to thank you so much for joining me, sir.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, brother. And I really appreciate all the good energy you bring, and your contributions are always absolutely solid gold. You'll be back next week when we do the On Your Shoulders. So thanks again, buddy.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Good night.
Okay, good night. And let me bring on Will Bennington of the No GM Trees movement. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Will Bennington of the Global Justice Ecology Project. Welcome, Will.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks.
Will, you're one of those wonderful people in this world who, when you saw a problem, not only were you prepared to put your own shoulder to the wheel, but you want to also help other people understand the problem. Talk to us just for a minute about Global Justice Ecology, and then we'll focus in on that project that brings us together. So tell us about Global Justice Ecology, Will.
Sure. Global Justice Ecology Project was founded back in 2004, sort of few years after the culmination of the anti-globalization movement, saw things like major protests in Seattle against the WTO and folks organizing around the World Bank and the IMF, but also kind of connecting that to the growing climate justice movement, folks around the world who are standing up to extreme energy and false solutions to the climate crisis, and trying to build alternative community-based solutions. So GJEP is kind of situated, or that's our acronym, GJEP. We're kind of situated in between the sort of anti-corporate globalization movements and the climate justice movements. And our big campaign right now is working to stop the release of genetically engineered trees into the wild, or some people might be more familiar with the term GMO trees. So the way we do that, we try to work in pretty broad alliances and to build strategic relationships, especially with frontline communities throughout the world. And right now we're shifting that focus to the southeastern United States, where a company called ArborGen is seeking approval to begin selling genetically engineered eucalyptus trees in 7 states throughout the southeastern U.S. Following kind of our strategy of trying to build relationships with local folks on the ground, that's what we've been doing, has also operated within the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and also the Convention on Biological Diversity, doing a lot of strategic media work supporting frontline indigenous communities and organizations throughout the world, and also pushing for a ban on GE trees in those spaces, and saying no and to false solutions to climate change in those spaces as well. And we also, we kind of support using all the tools in the toolbox. Unlike a lot of NGOs and nonprofits out there, we definitely support the use of direct action in fighting for political change. And we don't fight for compromises. We don't compromise on anything. We fight to win. We fight. Like right now, we're fighting for no GE trees. We're not asking for labeling of GE trees or some kind of certification for sustainable GE trees. We're saying no, and that is what we'll always be fighting for. And, just one last broad thing about GJEP. we really try to take a rights-based approach when we're talking about solutions to the impending ecological, social, and climate crises we're faced with. So we think that, you know, upholding the rights of communities and the rights of nature is paramount in all of the solutions that we're seeing put forth right now.
Well, many of us who've been watching the ecology slow motion disaster for some time have been really aware that the communities that suffer the most from, let's say, ecological damage, it's very rarely the districts where there's mansions or where there's large estate homes. It tends to be the poor who are given these ecological challenges. So it's really wonderful that you're combining ecology and economic justice as well. But let's talk specifically about these GM trees, and especially the eucalyptus. Why is it that they've focused in on eucalyptus? Is it oil? Is it burnability? What are they harvesting from these GE trees?
Yeah, so eucalyptus is already a pretty popular species throughout the world for industrial timber plantations. It's pretty diverse. It can be used for timber and for pulp, and increasingly work is being done to use it to produce liquid biofuels or bioenergy from biomass, from just burning the wood material without turning it into a liquid first. The reason that eucalyptus is so popular, aside from it being a tree that has a lot of uses, it's also extremely fast growing. They're looking at planting trees that would have an estimated rotation age between 3 and 7 years in the southeastern U.S. It's really, as opposed to a more typical tree species that you might plant where you might be looking at 20 to even 40 years for it to reach maturity or harvestable maturity, because of course maturity of a tree is, according to the timber industry, is a little bit different than according to that tree's actual biology. They're basically just looking for a fast growing feedstock that will produce a variety of materials, but in particular biomass for use in this sort of new bioeconomy that is being pushed upon the southeastern U.S. And the funny thing about eucalyptus is it actually doesn't grow very well down here. It's adapted to much warmer climates, native to Australia. It can grow in southern Florida. It grows in southern California. But it's really not adapted to the inland areas and the southeastern coast. And that's why they're trying to engineer this cold tolerant gene into it right now to expand its range north and inland.
Okay, now the next thing I want to talk about is you're aware of it, you're going to try to help other people be aware of it, so you have a campaign to inform people. Have you been one of the people that's going out to do these information lectures, these presentations?
Yep.
Excellent. Now, I understand that while there are those of us that would like to think that academia, the universities, the colleges, etc., are the ideal place for the growth and cultivation of a variety of ideas, it seems that you found that in practice that's not the case.
Yeah, I mean, you know, supposedly academic institutions are all about the free exchange of ideas and free speech, which of course, you know, in the United States, where at least myself as a white settler, I'm living on stolen land, and all these academic institutions are on stolen land, and they actually really only allow the exchange of a certain kind of ideas and thinking, which is sort of Western scientific rational thought. So we're within that context that they allow a free exchange of ideas. But
so,
nonetheless, it is the sort of place where you'd think you'd be able to come and provide a critique of some of the research that people are doing, especially if that critique is rooted in science and facts.
And as I understand it, the presentation, let's take, for example, the one in UF, the organization was invited to come and do a presentation. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, we were invited by a student who worked through a campus-recognized group to secure a room. I mean, it's publicly advertised. The room was confirmed by someone at UF.
But as I understand it, not only was the presentation stopped, but the group was ordered off campus.
Yeah, there were six of us that were there. Well, one was a student, and he isn't actually banned from campus, but the other five of us were issued notices against trespass and banned from U.S. property for 3 years.
Was this after a hearing, a discussion, some kind of adjudication, or was this by fiat?
Nope. No, this was just several police officers approached us and told us that someone told them we were acting suspicious and trying to break into a building, and they banned us from campus. And to be honest, citation that they gave us doesn't even look like an actual ticket or citation you would usually get from the police. It's just like a quarter sheet of paper, of white copy paper, that says it's a warning against trespass. There's no carbon copy or anything. It was a pretty illegitimate looking document in my mind.
Luckily, you weren't resisting arrest by breathing.
Yeah, it seemed likely that that might happen, but thankfully we got out of there without getting arrested.
Did I understand you also had trouble at Palm Beach College?
That was, I think, 2 days after the incident at UF, and we were informed, well, the provost at Palm Beach State College, she came in right before our presentation was supposed to start and was asking us who we were and if we were the presenters, and she asked to speak with the student who had organized, because we were brought there by, I believe it's the Ecology Club at Palm Beach State College. I think that's what they're called. They brought us there to speak. The provost pulled the student organizer out into the hallway and had a private conversation with her, which we learned from the student involved her saying that the FBI had contacted school either that morning or the day before, and sounds like maybe told them about the incident at University of Florida, but also told the school that we were known to be a disruptive group. That led the provost to decide that posting a security guard outside of the room the entire time we were giving a presentation was necessary. You know what this sounds like, policing free thought, even, at academic institutions, posting security outside of a room where someone's giving a lecture. That sounds a little bit like we're getting towards some Orwellian.
When ideas are sequestered in a free speech zone, when academia finds ideas outside the funding cycle as to be not just untoward, but disruptive, we really lose something very, very important in the world of dialogue. And, I have to salute you to help people understand significant issues when the powers that be have channeled the only acceptable facts in a very, very narrow vein. That's doing the best kind of science work. That's doing the best kind of civic action. You weren't there to destroy a classroom. You weren't there to disrupt a speaker. You weren't there to do anything more than provide information about a subject that is otherwise restricted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a shame. I've seen the same kind of thing happen myself. I was once ordered off the campus of a free school because I wasn't doctrinaire Marxist enough. So I have some experience in that arena. I want to say I think it's important, the work that you're doing. Are you going to try to continue to bring the information about the dangers of GM trees to other academic institutions or Sierra Club types and the Audubon Society folks?
Yeah, for sure. We're going to continue this outreach effort throughout Southeast. It's a particularly important time to be doing this kind of outreach because Arbor Gen has an application that's pending with the USDA for deregulation of their freeze-tolerant genetically engineered eucalyptus, which, by the way, eucalyptus is known to be a highly invasive species. It uses a lot of water, and it can be extremely flammable. So it's a pretty poor choice of an organism to start introducing in plantations throughout the southeastern U.S.
But
at the same time, we're also seeing this development of this new bioeconomy,
yeah.
Sort of research institutions and companies and government agencies want to take all the living carbon, all the living organic matter, and replace it, use it as a replacement for fossil fuels into the industrial economy. And the Southeast is sort of ground zero for that testing. So it's a crucial time for us to keep doing this outreach on university campuses where they're doing this research, to environmental organizations like the Sierra Club and environmental groups like Earth First and other folks, because we really need to be building a strong social movement that's going to resist this effort to continue the industrial economy by running it on genetically engineered organism and biomass and trees and all the living matter on the planet.
So if people want to learn more about GM trees, where would you direct
them? Well, you can go to our website, nogetrees.org. That's got a lot of information and resources on it and sort of a history of the work we've been doing to try to stop GE trees, all the way from the UN Convention on Biological Diversity, where we tried to get a global ban passed, down to the work we're doing today on the ground in the Southeast. I would also recommend checking out the Center for Food Safety. They just put out a new report on GE trees. We work in partnership with them on some stuff around GE trees. So they just put out a new report. If you just, you know, Google Center for Food Safety, genetically engineered trees, you'll be able to find it. It's a pretty good one. And yeah, just, you know, stay in tune to nogetrees.org and Global Justice Ecology Project. We'll definitely be sending out updates as we move forward on this campaign.
Well, if there's any announcements we can help you get out, let us know. If you've got a presentation in Florida someplace, we'd be glad to add
Great.
That to our list of announcements. Okay, thank you so much, Will.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, you take care. Have a good day, sir.
Let's sing one of Woody's old songs. And the geeks and the company pinks and the deputy sheriffs who made the raid. And when the news was called, she went to the union hall. And when the legion boys came round, she always stood her ground.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union till the day I die.
Yeah.
This union maid was wise to the tricks of company spies. She couldn't be fooled by the company stool. She'd always organize the guys. She'd always get her way. When she struck for better pay, she'd show her cards to the National Guard. And this is what she'd say. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union till the day I die.
You women who want to be free, just take a tip from me. Join your hand with a union man into the 21st century. As Angela Davis found, we're all together bound. Let race and class and gender join to stand on common ground.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking with the union, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union till the day I die.
Hey, come on.
Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union, I'm sticking to the union till the day I die. I'm sticking with the union.